Want to hear me get my ass kicked? Well then, welcome to the Right to Reason episode 15. I'm your host, Robert Stanley. This week's episode, we have a very special treat. Do you find legal stuff to be a little intimidating? Well, I do too. Andrew Torres from Opening Arguments will be joining us to explain all the details about legality that tends to get a little cloudy for the layman, aka you and me. He'll be talking about Trump, the Johnson Amendment, and whether law itself is designed to keep us uninformed and subservient. Before we engage those topics, Andrew absolutely destroys your host in a discussion that we all care about, the election. I'm a big Bernie supporter, and Andrew teaches me a few things that really challenge my views about Hillary, how Bernie was treated by the DNC, and my very basis of what I thought the electoral process was about. I don't like it! I hate being proven wrong, but when you're going up against a constitutional lawyer, it's time to shut up and listen. Maybe it's even time for you to rethink your views, if you're brave enough. You feeling brave enough to challenge your beliefs? Let's see what you got.
And let me assure you that we are going to take our fight for economic justice, for social justice, for environmental sanity, for a world of peace.
And I think it should be religion treated with ridicule and hatred and contempt, and I claim that right.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are a way for the cosmos to know itself.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought.
How much do you know about Hinduism? I'm going to use Hinduism to explain something that you wouldn't think has anything to do with it. Nuclear warfare. How do you build a nuke? It's not as crazy as you might think. I explain all that and relate the philosophy of planetary destruction back to the religion of Hinduism. Perhaps religion is behind nuclear warfare itself. Maybe not. I'll leave that to you. And after this episode, you'll have the valuable knowledge about both these topics to make an informed decision. Then we'll be talking to Gigi. She's going to tell us how you can support the underprivileged and help them get a valuable education. I'll then get into an argument with a lawyer. Never recommended, but I do it anyway. Andrew Torres does not go easy on me as you find out how much heat I can take while feeling the burn. I'm going to give you a special treat thereafter and finish up this episode with a Gigi blooper where she does her best to explain a topic that she knows nothing about. It's hilarious and she's cute as hell. All that starts right now.
Culture is not your friend. Culture is for other people's convenience and the convenience of various institutions, churches, companies.
We very naturally, as a cognitive and behavioral imperative, we form descriptions of the world and we try to figure out what's going on.
If you base the design of rockets on science, they reach the moon. It works, bitches.
Want to know how to make a nuclear bomb? I'm about to tell you, but first, we're about to focus on a topic that I know turns you on. Philosophy. Specifically, the philosophy of human destruction. To do that, we have to go back in time. Way back in time. The biblical gospel that refers to the Trinity was predated by the Bhagavad Gita by over 400 years. Vishnu, one of the principal deities of Hinduism, is the supreme being of the Trinity that is accompanied by Brahma and Shiva. Vishnu made himself into a man, much like the story of Christ being the incarnation of God the Father. This corporeal god form was known by the name that even Westerners like you might recognize, Krishna. It even sounds a little bit like Christ, doesn't it? Like Krishna. He came to help Arjuna, who is the protagonist of the ancient Indian epic Mahabharata, and plays a key role in the Bhagavad Gita alongside Krishna. Arjuna is faced with the difficult task of leading his army to war with his enemies that are his own kin. He has no interest in hurting people from his own family and tells Krishna that he will not fight. This story is analogous to all forms of war, even modern ones, wherein humanity is one and all battles between the human race, brother versus brother, as it were. Krishna provides Arjuna with multiple bits of wisdom, such as our own minds act as an enemy if we don't control it. It is better to perform one's own duties imperfectly than to master another's perfectly. Keep doing your work without thought of the result. Doing so is the secret to peace. Much like Christ's teachings, he instructed Arjuna, do what you love, and to give unto others without expectation of return. He also taught him the very difficult message that what you own today will be owned by someone else tomorrow, so you must learn the art of letting go. To live life in balance, don't oversleep, don't undersleep, don't overeat, don't undereat. Maintain harmony with everything in your life. And finally, the quintessential lesson facing Arjuna, as the dust was accumulating from the armies preparing for war, Krishna said, nothing is permanent in the universe. Whatever has come to life will eventually suffer death. So don't mourn for the ones who have left, because death is the ultimate reality of life. Krishna then told him that these people will die regardless of Arjuna's involvement, and that Arjuna was only a tool to Krishna's goal. Reading from Bhagavad Gita 3:42. The senses are higher than the body, the mind higher than the senses. Above the mind is reason. On this Right to Reason, we're going to be talking about the fiercest technology that man has ever designed to please Krishna and Shiva, the final emancipator, death itself. This Right to Reason is going nuclear right now. Arjuna didn't accept Krishna's challenge, so Krishna showed him his true form as Vishnu. This is the common image that you're familiar with of the blue effeminate guy with lots of arms all over the place. Standing before Arjuna as a great ferocious being, Vishnu then says this, "Now I am become death, destroyer of worlds." Flash forward to July 16, 1945. Robert Oppenheimer is a renowned scientist and friend of Albert Einstein, believe it or not. He is working on the Manhattan Project and administrating the Trinity Test in New Mexico, the site of the creation of the nuclear bomb. But what is a nuclear bomb made of? How do you make one? Well, here it is.
To re-emphasize the submicroscopic nature of our subject, if we could increase the size of the nucleus proton to that of a golf ball, the route of the electron would be about a mile away. Different forms of the same element, with different weights, but carrying the same electrical charges and having identical chemical behavior.
All right, let's simplify this. All you need to do is take nuclear material, surround it by something as simple as TNT, and then encase all that in some kind of a container. Not that hard! Just don't tell anyone I told you that.
The general ideas of how a nuclear weapon works, how to build a nuclear weapon, are out in the open literature, on the internet, various places. The details of how to make a nuclear weapon work are not necessarily there.
The problem is making the nuclear material. Things get kind of complicated right around there.
It employs a series of gas centrifuges and produces the same result for 1/20th of the energy costs. A centrifuge is a cylinder filled with uranium gas, spinning at 90,000 RPMs. This forces the heavier atoms to the outside of the cylinder. Only 7 uranium atoms in 1,000 are the lighter weight uranium-235, which remain on the inside.
In an interview from 1965, Oppenheimer describes the initial reactions as the fruit of his labors, the very first nuclear bomb detonated early in the morning of July 16, 1945.
I remembered the line from the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita. Vishnu is trying to persuade the prince that he should do his duty, and to impress him, takes on his multi-armed form and says, "Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds." I suppose we all thought that one way or another.
On May 7th, 1945, Germany signed an unconditional surrender at Allied headquarters in France to take effect the following day, ending the European conflict of World War II. Japan entered into negotiations of surrender 4 years before that with the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union, after the United States dropped the first bomb on Hiroshima, declared war on Japan and attacked. Then, 3 days later, the United States dropped another bomb on Nagasaki. If Japan was already willing to surrender, and Russia had already invaded, why did the United States continue their powerful display of nuclear arsenal? How was this the result, as the textbooks taught you, of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor that happened 4 years before this? Why have you been provided this narrative if it doesn't add up? Now you're asking the right questions. We'll get to that in another topic. Between now and then, let's take a final lesson from the Bhagavad Gita presented to us by our favorite religious philosopher, Alan Watts.
He who knows that it is indestructible and eternal, uncreated and unchanging, how can such a person slay anyone, O Arjuna, or cause anyone to slay? Just as a person casts off worn-out garments and puts on others that are new, even so does the embodied soul cast off worn-out bodies and take on others that are new. Weapons do not cleave this self. Fire does not burn him. Waters do not make him wet, nor does the wind make him dry. He is uncleavable. He cannot be burned. He can neither be wetted nor dried. He is eternal, all-pervading, unchanging and immovable. He is the same forever. He is said to be manifest, unmanifest, unthinkable, and unchanging. Therefore, knowing him as such, thou shouldst not grieve, even if thou thinkest that the self is perpetually born and perpetually dies. Even then, O mighty armed, thou shouldst not grieve, for to the one that is born, death is certain, and certain is birth for the one that has died. Therefore, for what is unavoidable, thou shouldst not grieve.
Perhaps the concept of the soul, of paradise, of life after this one, is the true root of our ability to inflict suffering on our fellow man. Maybe without these dreams of the afterlife, we wouldn't treat our current life and the lives of others with such disdain and apathy. Perhaps our impressive human abilities of technology could be utilized to help those that are weaker than us, rather than blowing someone up based on lines drawn in the earth. Earth. Dirt. Dirt that no matter where we come from, what our color, sexuality, or even religion, we all stand on together. Let's work to remove these lines of division and put the religious dogma of the Bronze Age where it belongs. Not in modern political policy, but in the history books to learn from. And let's try to remember the Bhagavad Gita's timeless message that reason is our only path to something greater than ourselves. Like listening to The Right to Reason? You can also watch it by subscribing to our YouTube channel, The Right to Reason.
Do you want to stay up to date on today's topic? Check out The Right to Reason on Facebook. Have an opinion? Join the discussion on Twitter at Right to Reason. You know you want to.
If you feel the right to reason and the conversations we have on this podcast to be valuable, then please know that while this broadcast is provided to you for free, it is not free to produce. Please visit my Patreon page. It's easy to remember. It's patreon.com/right. There are multiple rewards available to all patrons, even those of you that contribute just a dollar. You can also find the link on my website at therighttoreason.com. If you are able to make this show possible, know that your support contributes to getting the message you care about out to those that may not have heard it. Those of you that are already helping, know that we are creating this production together. All my listeners are part of this show, but those that support it are facilitators that are turning our whisper into a resounding message in the marketplace of ideas. If you think this show is worth a buck, or even more, visit patreon.com/right.
This This is Russell Glasser from The Atheist Experience, and I'm standing up for your right to reason.
Thomas Westbrook here from Holy Kool-Aid, and you're listening to The Right to Reason.
Hey there, this is Damian Lee Four from the metal band Predator, a band that defends atheism, and you're listening to The Right to Reason.
And we are back with another GG Spot. GG, what do you have for us today?
Good morning, good morning. Today, actually, I want to talk about SEO, and this is Sponsors for Educational Opportunity. These guys are actually pretty cool. I mean, you know, with Betsy DeVos in office now and all the fun-filled budget cuts they're going to put across the United States right now, these guys are one of the very few that are really out there trying to help get our youth educated. It really focuses with our underprivileged. It focuses on different colored skin. So, I mean, anybody that's not going to have that...
Like albinos?
Yeah, it's just anybody that's going to have a harder time getting in, but anybody by their appearance, anybody that's going to be of lower income, these are the places that you can go to get your children that help to get out there. So anyway, so these guys, basically, they have these really cool programs, and they have the proven track record along with it. Okay, so they have this SEO Scholars, and basically it's a free 8-year academic program that's going to get all of, you know, your underserved public high school kids through college. And what's really cool about this is once you enroll in this program, it's a proven track record. They have 90% of their enrollees graduate. Okay. That's a pretty high.
Graduate from that college.
Right.
That's fantastic.
Graduate. And what's really cool is they also have a program where they get you into careers as well. And so along with that, once you enroll, not only are you going to get 90% of the students that are going to graduate, but then you go into their careers program, and these guys, they do about 80% of their graduates are going to be enrolled in some type of intern program. And then after their internship is over, they're going to have a full-time job offer from their different partner companies that they've been interning at. So, I mean, it really just gives them a leg up on, you know, hey, I'm not going to be working at McDonald's all my life. All right, so this is a 4-star rated program or charity nonprofit over on Charity Navigator. I feel free to take the liberty of checking these guys out. I'm telling you, they are absolutely fabulous for helping out the kids. And especially, like I said, with our budget cuts, somebody's got to be out there supporting these kids.
Thanks, Devos.
You're right.
If you had to do somebody on Trump's team, who would you do?
Well, clearly, I'm going to go with Scaramucci. if he could talk that dirty, I wonder what he does in bed. Anyway. Just
all
kidding.
Right. Well, thank you, Gigi. What's the name of the thing again?
Okay, so it's SEO. It's Sponsors for Educational Opportunity.
Sponsors for Educational Opportunity.
Please, whenever you get a free time, just go on to therighttoreason.com. Click under the link that says GG Spot and just scroll down till you see SEO, and it's going to take you directly to their donate page. Check out the programs. And not only that, let's say you're fixing to graduate. Maybe you need some help. Go onto the program and see if you can't get some help. The application process is actually pretty simple. Check it out. Cool. Hope y'all have a wonderful day. Thanks.
If you won't reason, you're intolerant. If you can't reason, you're dumb. But if you're scared to, you're a slave.
Heaven sent my residence, it's heaven, they're just visiting. Blending in the hiding light, shining it, guiding light, finding it, this vehicle I'm riding in, this soul of mine, divine it is.
Hi everyone, Michael Shermer here. You have a right to reason, and you're listening to Robert Stanley's terrific podcast. Have a good day.
I know I can change this, I just gotta pick myself.
step up and move on.
Hey, this is Dave Blair rocking out to you, and you're listening to Right to Reason with Robert Stanley.
I ain't gotta do nothing. I just gotta pick my stuff up and move on.
So I have learned a lot about sex lately. Yes, you heard me right. Sex. Sex. Not just fun to do, guys. It's also a topic that we should probably be studying very thoroughly. I had no idea how much it had been influenced by religion. Dr. Daryl Ray, author of The God Virus, explores these topics in his latest book, Sex and God. Why is human sexuality so important, and why does religion obsess on it? They love it. You will be surprised to learn how much religion has influenced your sexuality, who you marry, the pleasure you do or maybe don't get, and most importantly, what you can do about it. You can find this book and many others under the Books tab at therighttoreason.com. The book recommendations I provide to you aren't just a list of books that have greatly affected me. It's also a great way for you to help support the show. Anytime you buy something through that website, some dude in a suit starts flicking nickels at our production costs. And you probably know every cent helps. So please visit therighttoreason.com and just click books. Participate in the show and learn more by visiting our website at therighttoreason.com.
Told me that I have the right to reason.
And welcome back. I am really happy to have Andrew Torres on our show today from Opening Arguments Podcast. He also runs the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC. And this one's interesting. Author of Off Base, New Insights into an Old Game. Are you like a baseball nut or something, Andrew?
So first, Rob, thank you for having me on the show. I really appreciate it. And I'm looking forward to it. Second, yeah, I wrote a book on baseball, kind of a like pre-Moneyball book back in the late 90s.
Cool.
I have always been a baseball nut, and I have some baseball clients. It's a great game. I rarely get asked about that. And sadly, I no longer make any royalties off the book, so I guess I don't promote it anymore. But no, it was great. It was a lot of fun to do.
Cool. I've never been like a big sports guy. I played football in high school, but you know, other than that, like I never followed it a lot.
What attracted me, I was a scrawny little kid. I was short and I was skinny and that ruled out an awful lot of sports when I was young growing up. And baseball is the great equalizer, right? Like you can be a, you know, scrawny little kid and play second base and pitch and have just as much success as, you know, that kid who's 6'5" and 14. I say that now as the parent of a scrawny 14-year-old on a travel baseball team. So that was why I fell in love with it. I could have never played football. I was like 82 pounds when I was in high school.
So. Yeah, see, I was the fat kid, so I was a lineman, and I was able to just to not let someone get past me, and I was really good at it. So. But that's all I could do is just stand there. It was hard to move me.
Hey, that's an important skill.
You know what kind of interests me about baseball a little bit is how much I've seen it change. Like if I look into like the, you know, the old Babe Ruth kind of baseball stuff, like these are all like these gonna eat a big old steak, down some beer, and go out there and hit the ball a couple times kind of thing. And now it's this very athletic kind of sport, you know, like it's a totally different feel almost.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, in my view, there are two sort of major changes. The first is the stratification of athleticism in the sport. I mean, even, you know, you want to pick like the, you know, fattest baseball players you can come up with. And, you know, you can come up with a guy. But if you met them in real life, you would nevertheless be impressed by, you know, just how good a shape they're in compared to the average person. I once played a pickup softball game in which we were at the park and just, you know, goofing around, and a former Baltimore Oriole, you know, came up, and he was a backup player with the Orioles, right? He's one of those guys who you were like, oh yeah, you know, lays down a bunt, you know, can't really hit, that kind of thing.
Right.
And played in our game, and everything he hit about 700 feet, right? Like, I mean, it was just the difference between him and, you know, a bunch of guys playing beer league softball was as big a gap as you could possibly imagine.
Yeah, it's like a more all about technique, right? And hitting it just right. And
that level of athletic skill, right? Like when you are watching on TV and, like, you know, calling that guy, you know, the fat reliever or the fat backup catcher or whatever, that's in comparison to guys who are, you know, 3% body fat and can bench 440 pounds, or, like, I mean, it's still on a scale.
Right. Right. Yeah. People you wouldn't want to make angry, basically.
No.
So what is opening arguments for the listeners that might not have heard of this one yet? I love the show. I love it.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. Yeah, my podcast has nothing to do with baseball. It's just a chance to chat sports, and I enjoy it. So I got off on that tangent. Opening arguments. The idea is, in this era of fake news, we take legal stories that have we take news stories that have a legal component, and if that story has been reported incorrectly, and basically, if it's a story about the law, it's been reported incorrectly.
Right.
We try and clarify that. So I'm a practicing lawyer. I'm a, you know, Harvard Law grad, big firms, 20 years, my own firm for the last 3 years. My co-host, Thomas Smith, is a veteran podcaster. He's got a couple different shows, most notably Serious Inquiries Only, which is a fantastic show. And we got together. He is not a lawyer. He's an ex-accountant, now full-time podcaster, radio guy. And he asks the questions that I wouldn't otherwise know people would ask while I'm trying to explain why the New York Times got this particular legal story wrong. And you sort of put that together.
Yeah, I love the camaraderie that you two have, because you'll just start laying down this, you know, fact upon fact upon fact, where I'm just like, whoa, it's hard for me to keep up. And he'll just kind of like cut in with some kind of like light humor about it. But like you said, you know, asking the kind of question I would want to ask you, you know, like if I was sitting in front of a lawyer, this is what I would ask him. And then you're like, oh yeah, let me back up, you know, cause you're like this V that, and this year came up, you know, and blah, 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 blah. And then he's like, well, hold on. Does that mean that that's illegal? And you'll be like, well, you know, it's a elusive term. Let me explain. Yeah. It's great camaraderie, and it's a lot of fun.
Well, thank you very much. I mean, yeah, in my view, that's what makes the show, right? Like it would be dreadfully boring as an hour long legal lecture. I know, because I often lecture on the law, and I can, you know, assess how the audience is enjoying it, or lack thereof. But you don't, I mean, when you've been in this world for, you know, 22 years, it is, you forget sometimes what, you know, you get immersed in your own vocabulary, and it can be a challenge to be like, oh, look, like, no, we've got to go back and explain, like, what's the difference between a complaint and an indictment, right? Like, otherwise I might sort of assume, kind of talking forward. So yeah, like Thomas is what, in my view, Thomas is what makes the show. So,
it's certainly a great team. I love when you guys get into the constitutional law stuff, because that's the stuff that anytime I think that, whether you're liberal or conservative or, you know, wherever you fall, green, libertarian, what have you, that's where, whenever you're talking to someone that you disagree with about politics, that's where everybody kind of just gives up. It's, we'll bounce back and forth. well, you know, I have this moral claim about this, or I have this fiscal claim about that, or, you know, whatever. And then we get to some kind of constitutional thing, and we both feel like we know what we're talking about, but you just get to this point where you go, yeah, I don't know. Is that a violation? I'm not really sure. And that, to me, when I listen to your show, I kind of feel like I've got a little bit of ammo for the next time I talk to somebody about politics, you know?
Oh, great. Well, that's why we called the show Opening Arguments, right? The idea was to give you the proper background so that when you go off and have those discussions, you know, you don't, you know, kind of make basic errors. And, you know, and a really good example of that is, you know, I'm sure you've seen this when you're having a discussion about freedom of speech, and someone will throw in First Amendment, and, you know, they'll throw that in when they're talking about, like, people deleting a comment on Facebook, right? And you know, as an OA listener, you know, the First Amendment doesn't apply on Facebook. So, you know, so we try and do that. Our politics are definitely left of center, but we try and flag that up front. And in fact, I think we do a fair amount of I can't say we do at least as much fact checking of Occupy Democrats as we do of Donald Trump, because Donald Trump is Donald Trump.
Well, it's just constant with this guy. Like, it is relentless. And I recently posted a video on YouTube. The title was Everything You Need to Know About Trump's Connections with Russia. Man, it was 2 days of research. I got everything, and I left a lot of stuff out because I'm like, man, I can't really prove that one. I don't want to play that game, you know, where you just throw out some hearsay stuff. I just put the info that was really relevant that I could actually fact check for the audience. The very next day, he had told the Russians, allegedly gave the Russians some secrets about laptops on airplanes and that sort of thing. And I thought, boy, I could have used that one, you know, but I mean, it's constant. Like, you can't keep up.
Yeah, I used to, even after the election, I mean, I would have this schedule where, you know, in November, December of 2016, I would get on and say to myself, okay, I'm going to spend 2 hours on social media, you know, interacting with fans of the show, promoting the show, that sort of thing. And I could do that, right? Like, I could get on at 8 o'clock, I could go till 10, I could get on Twitter, I could get on Facebook, I could talk to fans of the show, answer a couple questions, promote our next episode. After the inauguration, I would get on at 7:30, 8 o'clock at night, and it would be 2 a.m. and I still hadn't made a dent yet, right? Like, because things were happening and are still happening at just such a breakneck pace. Like, it's not usual in the legal world for, you know, a court to hand down a temporary restraining order at 11 o'clock at night, which is what happened, you know, with the first court that enjoined Trump's executive order on travel restrictions, the so-called Muslim ban. You know, that broke at like 11 o'clock at night. And I was just in the middle of everything. And it's it's daunting.
Yeah.
This is not normal.
Speaking of that Muslim ban thing, I actually had like a couple questions I wanted to ask you, but you brought it up and I wasn't even thinking about that one, but yeah, what is going on with, is this something that they're just going to keep coming out with new ways to introduce this ban until it gets through the courts, or what's going on?
I don't know the answer to that question, and I will tell you why I don't know the answer to the question. Okay. Because before, as the Muslim ban was being proposed, Thomas and I did a show in which we went through the statutory authorization that the president has. It's very, very clear to restrict immigration based on an entire group of people, to restrict it by country. The president has wide discretion to do what he's trying to do. And we essentially said that. We said, hey, look, like, you know, elections have consequences. And this is somebody who has been campaigning on this issue. And if you think, you know, he's probably just kidding or angry or whatever, like, you know, I don't know why you would think that, he's going to try and do it, and he's probably going to be successful. What we didn't count on was the sheer level of incompetence in the Trump administration, because what you can do is, right, like, the president has the power when acting to, in the best interests of national security, to issue broad restraints on on immigration into and out of the country. But what you can't do is engage in unconstitutional discrimination against a group of people. That is prohibited by the First Amendment, but the test on that is so onerous, it is so difficult to prove, that that I essentially discounted that the first time when we were talking about the Muslim ban. I said, you know, look, and I advised the listeners, I said, look, there's this case called City of Hialeah versus Florida, but here's what you have to do. And so in that case, what happened was it was in the city of Hialeah, Florida, and a guy wanted to bought a building and wanted to practice the Santeria religion, which involves ritual sacrifice of chickens as part of the key rites, right? And that seems a little weird, but like, I don't know. I mean, you know, it's kind of no weirder than a grown man who's promised never to have sex with anyone giving 13-year-old girls glasses of wine, right? Like, I mean, it's weird, but all religion is weird.
Or believing that my cracker is going to turn into the body of Christ, or
right, exactly. And it's not, you know, it's not like it's portrayed on TV sometimes where, you know, they've got like a live chicken and they cut it open and there's blood spraying. I mean, it's a hygienic, whatever. It's a practice of the religion of Santeria. The county council in the city of Hialeah got together and banned animal sacrifice within the city. Okay. And it's clear they've got the power to do that on sort of health grounds. But they gave away the game because the legislature got together and they had testimony. And the testimony was, you know, witnesses would come forward saying, we need to pass this law because if we do, that means that those crazy Santeria won't be able to open up their church. And Jesus Christ would want us to do this. And like, you looked through the record and it was just so egregious that the bill was motivated by discrimination against practitioners of Santeria. That the Supreme Court said, look, when you get to this part, that violates the First Amendment. That is clearly animus against a group of people on the basis of religion, and we're going to strike down this law. That's the test that you need to keep in the back of your mind when the courts are looking at Trump's executive order. And the problem is that they're not helped by what Trump and his associates have actually said, right? So it's now a part of the record that that Donald Trump went to Rudy Giuliani and said, hey, help me keep out the Muslims. How do I write this executive order thing so I keep out all the Muslims and I make it fair, right? And that's a bad fact to have in the record when you then try and go convince a court that you're not really trying to keep out all the Muslims.
Throughout his whole campaign, he campaigned very, very specifically about we're going to keep out the Muslims. And then I'm watching the video of, I want to say it was the second judge that turned it out. It was the guy.
The Northern District of California.
Yes. Thank you. He said, yeah, but you know, I have to look at intent as well. And here he clearly has intent to, you know, make this about a religion.
And yeah.
Go ahead. That's insane. Like, why would you think you'd get away with that?
Well, why would Trump think he could get away with it? Because, you know, he has 70 years of history of getting away with literally everything. So I'm not surprised at that. You actually anticipated where I was going. I was going to tell you that in that Northern District of California opinion, which issued a temporary restraining order that prevents the executive order from going into effect, pending full review on the merits. That TRO has been appealed to the Ninth Circuit and is also pending review on the merits. One of the things the judge did that I found really, really interesting was he included transcripts. He took judicial notice of the transcripts of the third debate between Trump and Hillary Clinton. And you might recall that in between the second and third debates was the vice presidential debate in which Mike Pence came out and was, you know, sort of sober and reasonable and, you know, the one of the questions he was asked was, well, you know, your boss has said you're going to kick out all the Muslims and you're going to ban all Muslims from coming into the country. And Pence was like, oh, of course not. What a terrible, you know, misconstruction of the erudite foreign policy. You know, it was just like, you know, whatever. basically walked it back. So then Lester Holt, I believe it was Lester Holt, asked Trump about that statement in the third debate. And Trump, of course, couldn't help himself. Trump said, oh, yeah, OK, look, what we're going to do is we're going to call it extreme vetting. But extreme vetting means the Muslim ban. The Muslim ban, extreme vetting, it's all the same thing. Right. And he couldn't help it. Right. And now that's a part of the court record. And so, you know, to get back to the ultimate question, my evaluation, right, like when I recorded on this twice, you know, once during the campaign in 2016, in August or September of 2016, where I said, hey, look, you've got to take this seriously because Donald Trump is campaigning on a Muslim ban. And if he is president, as far as I can tell, he's got the power to do this. So, you know, take that seriously. I guess I didn't reach enough people. One of my regrets from 2016 is that I did not get out there and campaign harder. And then in November, December, we looked at the same thing and we said, hey, look, you know, he's announced his intention to impose restrictions on immigration. And he's likely to be able to do that. Now we flagged there were initial problems. The first issue, the first executive order failed to distinguish between those who were applying to come into the United States and those who had a pre-existing right to return to the United States. And the ACLU immediately challenged that, won, and then the courts basically gave Trump the blueprint for how to fix it, which he did with the second EO. But I did not credit seriously the animus argument because of how tough it is to prove. But I don't know how you get around that is ultimately the answer, right? I started with, I don't know, I'm going to go back to an answer, I don't know, because the record is just clear. And I don't know how you untaint the record other than, you know, a show where, you know, you bring Rudy Giuliani into the room and the press and you say, okay, all of us here assembled are taking into account the fact that we definitely don't want to discriminate against Muslims. So how do we do something where we definitely don't discriminate against Muslims? and maybe you do a stunt like that. I don't know. But it went from a situation where I didn't think the courts could block it to, you know, Trump handing the courts all the ammunition they needed by with his own statement.
Maybe if they just made the ban against countries where terrorists had attacked us or had come from and attacked us, you know, even then that would make some sense where we could go, oh, okay, that's why you're choosing it. But he's obviously choosing countries that have zero to nothing to do with any of these terrorist attacks.
Well, and that's because he's got to walk a line, right? Like the Muslim ban, like building a wall with Mexico, is never intended to be a serious policy proposal. You can't find anybody who thinks that this will actually make the country safer, right? What he has to do is tell his base, I am keeping out the Muslims because that's what they want. But then he has to be able to send folks into court to say, oh, no, but that's not really good. You know, I'm not really doing that. And that's a hard line to walk. And it's an exceptionally hard line to walk when, you know, you have zero political experience and you're surrounded by people who either have zero political experience or are incredibly bad at it. You know, a really good illustration of this is the Sanctuary Cities order. We covered this on Opening Arguments. In the public, Donald Trump and Jeff Sessions said, the whole point of the Sanctuary Cities order is we are going to defund all federal dollars that go to San Francisco and other sanctuary cities if they don't start complying with our requirements that they turn over data to Immigration and Naturalization Services. But then you can't do that, right? Like Congress has the power to allocate money. So when that was challenged in the courts, Trump's lawyers refused to defend the policy on the merits. They said, no, this executive order doesn't mean any of that. It would not defund San Francisco. It would not take away any federal dollars from San Francisco. I mean, it was astonishing reading the case of, you know, kind of the out of one side of the administration's mouth is, you know, we're going to, you know, lock up San Francisco. And on the other side where the lawyers going, well, this is just bombast. This really doesn't mean what it says it means.
You know, on one end, it's almost like I'm thinking this guy, he knows how to play people. He's been playing people for so long in his, you know, businesses and stuff. And he knows how to say this to get the base and then how to pull right out of that later on, you know, technically not be held responsible for something. And then I just see him doing just really obnoxiously dumb things and saying really stupid things. And I'm like, I don't know if he's just really good at this kind of publicity stuff and how to get, you know, finagle his way through this junk, or if the guy's just a bumbling fool. And I remember right whenever it was Hillary debate time, you know, it was mid last year. And I remember thinking, you know, if Trump becomes president and isn't immediately impeached or kicked out or replaced or something, it's going to really let us know that this antiquated system of having one leader rule a country, you know, I get, you know, you've got all the executive and judicial and, you know, you got all these different branches and all the system to keep checks and balances in place. But essentially, there is kind of like one main person running the country, and it seems like such a silly idea. And I remember saying, if he does this and he can actually pull it off for the first 100 days, which we're right there, you know, it's going to really let us know that this position is, while it's dangerous to put the wrong person in it, obviously, but it's still mostly just a show. This is just how the wool is pulled over our eyes in a way, because this would have to be somebody that knows what they're doing to be able to do the job. I couldn't become CEO of my company for a couple months and you not notice that, you know, the company just went under very quickly because I'm not qualified. But if somebody can become president that's obviously not qualified and still be pulling this job off, even though badly, destructively, but still doing the job, obviously this whole president idea is just BS.
So there's a lot to unpack there. In my view, this election was, you know, sort of a confluence of a lot of factors, but the entirety of the opposition of the pro-Trump side is essentially a coalition of people who were really, 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 really angry, and they wanted to vote to send the message that they were angry. And I think when I talk to people who voted for Trump, and some of the people I talk to who voted for Trump are still pro-Trump for reasons that are hard to fathom, but some of the people will say to me, well, I didn't really think he was going to do this. I just was mad. I just didn't like Hillary Clinton. I didn't like X or Y or Z. And so I hope that, you know, one of the takeaways that people will learn from this election is, you know, something I say all the time, which is your vote is not a message. Your vote does not communicate like the way you're feeling about someone. Your vote is, and this is all it is, it's a very imperfect tool to choose between which of two people you want to put into a particular job. You might not like that. You might be a third party activist or whatever, but it doesn't like that. Then figure out how to change the rules or whatever. Your vote in the history of elections, there has never been a time that I can find in which politicians have looked at results and said, oh, well, what this was trying to do was tell me to do Y, so I'm going to do that now. No. What your vote does is it sticks someone in office. And what this vote did was stick a 70-year-old game show host with no public experience and no history of caring about the public interest in any way whatsoever into the nation's highest office, which is, you know, terrifying and awful, and I don't need to go into that. Look, I mean, I practice law in the United States, right? I have not fled to Canada. I routinely on my show, I defend the U.S. system. Like, for example, I think our system of free speech is superior to the European model. There's a lot that I consider myself a patriot, and I love this country. And so I have some optimism that, you know, this is a costly lesson to have learned, but maybe we've learned something. And I want to try and, you know, emphasize those messages.
Speaking of messages, that is, I'm still kind of recoiling from what you just said, actually, is your vote is not a message. I got to tell you, I feel angry when I hear you say that. Like, that makes me angry because I think that is my message. You know, I have the right to vote, and I'm going to vote for the person that I want so that I can get my message out there. But I can't respond to your point in anything other than passion and emotion. I can't give you a logical defense of my position as to why I would feel like it's a message, you know? And yeah, that's a tough one, Andrew. That's a pretty good point.
I you know, one of the things I said earlier, right? Like, you know where my politics are. They've been pretty clear in this interview. But I want to take people with whom I largely agree and make sure that, you know, they don't get a free pass just because I agree with them. What our system does is, in the primary, you have the opportunity to pick the person in your party that most closely reflects your beliefs. But then in the general election, you have a binary choice. And the idea of, I mean, the number of people that said to me before the election, and these are people that I have not let up on, because they are directly responsible for President Trump, who said, well, you know, look, let's look at 538. And, like, I mean, Hillary Clinton's obviously going to win. So, you know, I'm going to vote for, you know, Jill Stein or Gary Johnson in my state because that's going to send the message that. And I was like, no, it's not going to send any goddamn message.
Yeah, but that's exactly what I did. Is after I was a Bernie supporter and I recognized that Trump, or really any one of those guys from the conservative side, was going to be the devil, except what was his name, Kasich? He seems reasonable.
Yeah, he ran as the reasonable guy. His record in Ohio has a lot of scary stuff in it. But keep going. I don't mean to.
No, fair enough. So whenever the DNC did what they did to Bernie in Nevada and California and pretty much every place that they were.
Oh, can we go into that? Because I want to challenge you on that.
Okay, sure. Fair? Yeah.
I don't want to lose track of the overall story.
Well, no, I'll just wrap up. That once that happened, I said there is no possible way that I will vote for Hillary Clinton, and I don't really care if the whole fucking world burns. I will not vote for somebody that stole my opportunity or stole this candidate's opportunity to fairly get in the general election.
So let's kind of work backwards. So number one, do you regret that now? Would you like to go back and hold your nose? But I don't know what state you're in.
No, Texas. So you know, but
hey, but
if I looked at it in retrospect, and I would say that if Jill Stein's numbers could have gone to Hillary, then Trump wouldn't have won. In that case, you know, okay, if the Electoral College wasn't a major factor and it was based on popular vote,
we know that that's the case, right? Like, it is her margins in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan are less than 100,000 votes across those three states. So, yeah, like, disaffected liberals who stayed home or who voted for Jill Stein or whatever, if they had not done that, then Hillary Clinton would be president. Absolutely. 100%.
But you're adding in the secondary variable of stay at home as well. And, I mean, that's a pretty big margin to add. I mean, would you emphatically say that if people that voted for Jill Stein had have voted for Hillary Clinton, Hillary Clinton would be president now?
Let's answer that. I am pulling up the Wikipedia article right now on the presidential election, and let's go down to the state by state results. The only states we care about are Wisconsin, and Michigan, three traditionally Democratic states. So Pennsylvania, the margin is 44,000 votes, right? 2970 for Trump, 2926 for Hillary Clinton. That's 44,000 votes. And Jill Stein got 49,941 votes. So it would have flipped Pennsylvania. Let's go to Michigan. Michigan, 2268 for Hillary Clinton, 2279. That is 11,000 votes in Michigan. Jill Stein got 51,000 votes. And Wisconsin. Wisconsin is 1382 for Hillary Clinton, 1405. That is 23,000 votes, and Jill Stein got 31,000 votes in Wisconsin. So yes, that doesn't count. So I threw in, you know, people who stayed home or people who voted for Gary Johnson. You don't need to go there. You take people who voted for Jill Stein, that is, the people who ought to have been the most horrified at Donald Trump being president in swing states, said, nope, it is more important for me to vote against Hillary Clinton than it is to prevent an unqualified monster from being president. And
I'm flipping through Google as you're talking, and you kind of got ahead of me a little bit, but based on the information you're giving, that's a very powerful argument, and I have no rebuttal to that, Andrew. That's at least in the swing states, we could say. Jill Stein did affect Clinton's ability to become president.
Yeah, and this goes to, and I made this point back in opening arguments episode number one. It was the first one, and I made it because, look, I didn't seriously think Donald Trump could be president. But the lesson that I wanted to do, those first four episodes of opening arguments, we revisited the election of 2000, which is an exact repeat of 2016. Incredibly close election in which a liberal spoiler candidate materially affected the presidency and resulted in and smeared, by the way, somebody who is a genuinely good public servant and a deeply committed progressive in Al Gore. Like what Ralph Nader did to Al Gore was shameful. And one of the takeaways that I tried to give, that I said explicitly at the end of those episodes, was nobody thought, when you look at the states, right, any of the, you know, because it was a 3 electoral vote difference, any of these states would have been sufficient. Al Gore lost West Virginia. And you think of West Virginia as like a deep red coal mining state right now. West Virginia was a deep blue state. It was one of only 10 states that voted for Michael Dukakis in 1988 when, you know, when he was getting, you know, the floor wiped with him. Nobody thought that Al Gore could lose West Virginia. Al Gore lost his home state of Tennessee. And again, you know, we think of Tennessee as being a, you know, southern state, whatever. But candidates, you know, Clinton and Gore won Tennessee back-to-back years in 92 and 96, and it was Al Gore's home state. Nobody expected him to lose his home state. Al Gore lost New Hampshire, and Clinton and Gore won New Hampshire in back-to-back years, 92 and 96. And the lesson is nobody thought Michigan – everybody thought Pennsylvania was kind of a swing state. Nobody thought Michigan was a swing state this year. Nobody thought Wisconsin was a swing state this year. You can't predict in advance, right? Yeah. I gotta say that you don't know. And so you cannot go into it and go, my state isn't a swing state, therefore it's okay for me to throw my vote away or, you know, cast a protest vote or whatever. Like, I think you got to go in. And look, I live in Michigan. I live in Michigan. Let me say that. Look, I live in Maryland, right? Like, that is a Democrat plus 30 state. And I watched where 4 years ago we had a gubernatorial election in which the Democratic candidate was polling 25 points above the Republican. Nobody really liked him all that much, and the Republican won on election day, right? Like, you just can't do that. So that's okay. My soapbox.
Give me your counter argument. I want to push a little bit from a different angle here. I grant you that in the swing states, Jill Stein did make a difference. However, and just as a side note, I loved, what was that, like 3 or 4 episodes you did on the Al Gore Bush election or something? Mm-hmm. I loved those. You broke down every detail, and even though I experienced that, you know, I was watching it on the news at the time, until you broke that down for me, that really didn't make sense. You know, it was all just campaign rally images in my head, and it was just anger and frustration, and it wasn't explained to me just by being a witness and participant in that election up until I listened to opening arguments. So if anybody's thinking about checking out that podcast, obviously you might prefer to check the current event ones, you know, and be more recent, but if you have the chance, go back and check out his synopsis on Al Gore. But anyway, to push back on your point, whenever they presented these two candidates, and I'm going to say they because the people didn't. You could say that the people presented Trump, perhaps, in the sense of the RNC seems to be a little bit more fair than the DNC and how people get to the general election, how candidates get to the general election, perhaps. But here we have Trump on one end, that there is a lot of evidence that there was Russian influence for his election, okay? And then you have Hillary Clinton on the other end, who was also put there, not by the people, as it were, DNC.
So where's your evidence for that?
I saw what they did. I saw what they did in Nevada, for example, where they weren't letting delegates that would have voted Bernie Sanders be able to contribute.
I want to unpack because we can talk about each and every specific event. But let's be very, very clear about this. The only reason that Bernie Sanders was within any appreciable distance of Hillary Clinton in terms of the delegates is that Bernie Sanders grossly overperformed in states that held caucuses, which are, of course, the least democratic way of selecting a candidate. Bernie Sanders racked up delegates in caucus states, which reward the intensity of support because it's a longer process. It's held at a specific time in the day. It's harder for casual supporters to get out there. And so take Nevada, for example. Bernie Sanders won the Nevada caucus and picked up a huge margin of delegates in the Nevada caucuses. Nevada then holds a non-binding primary, which Hillary Clinton won. Right. And that didn't award any delegates. But if you were trying to get an estimate of from a Democratic standpoint, what numbers of people actually support a candidate, there is zero evidence that greater numbers of people support Bernie Sanders. What there was evidence was that there was some and it wasn't super close in terms of delegates.
I mean, did you see these rallies where, I mean, whole streets were just filled with Bernie supporters constantly? Sure.
Right, but we don't measure, we don't award primaries to the size of rallies, right? We award primaries to who comes out and votes and how those votes turn into delegates, and then how those delegates turn into, exceeding a certain threshold. And I would strongly challenge the idea that anything that happened in 2016. So let me take a step back. I want to make this as a concession. Which then I'm going to immediately undercut. If the point you want to make is people in the DNC did not like Bernie Sanders, lifelong socialist, not a Democrat, and did not want him to be the nominee, that is 100% correct. Okay, so if you want to say, was Bernie Sanders mistreated by the DNC? Yep, Bernie Sanders was mistreated by the DNC. If you want to say, did the DNC take the nomination from Bernie Sanders? There's zero evidence for that, and I will strongly dispute that.
Bernie Sanders was mistreated by the DNC and somehow it's still Democratic? How can you put those two things together?
I will put those together in a minute, but before I do that, what I want to say is, did you follow the 2004 Democratic primary at all? Because I was a big Howard Dean supporter in 2004. That was the first.
And we're going to take Washington. Yay!
And I will tell you, if you go back and look to see what the DNC did to Howard Dean in 2004, it does not compare to what the Bernie supporters are arguing now. Howard Dean was brutally mistreated by the DNC in 2004. They funded buttons. First, they approved an illegal loan to John Kerry from himself in order to keep him in the race, because Kerry was the institutional candidate, the Hillary Clinton of 2004. They distributed buttons that said, dated Dean, married Kerry. They brought the institutional weight of every supporter on every elected official to say, you have to endorse John Kerry, you cannot endorse Howard Dean. They stripped several delegates of their ability to participate in the process. It was an enormous screw job on Howard Dean. And they were able to put it in place sufficiently that it tanked Dean's numbers going into Iowa, and he came out, failed to meet expectations, and then had the famous Dean Scream moment that you've talked about, that again was sort of ridiculous the way it was portrayed in the press. But through that, and you know, I was a big Dean supporter, and I hated what they did to him. And then I went out and I pulled the lever for John Kerry in November anyway, because George W. Bush is a fucking monster. and that's what your obligation is to do, right? Like, so I'm going to get to on the facts, but the biggest thing is, right, the primaries are where you want to get your candidate. Sometimes you don't get your candidate legitimately. Sometimes you don't get your candidate because political parties screw your guy out of the nomination that you think is rightfully his. But in any event, it's your job, if you care about the Republic, to suck that up and say, don't really like what they did to Howard Dean, not willing to shoot off my own face because I'm mad about that. And Kerry was as terrible a candidate as I thought he would be as a Dean supporter, and he lost. But he didn't lose because Democrats turned on him, which to me is the big distinction. So,
but Andrew, that from revolutions don't happen overnight, and you can't say that this next time. I mean, don't you think perhaps this next time the DNC is going to be at least a little bit more careful in how they handle the primaries, and is going to say, look, if we present a candidate like Hillary Clinton and we do it in a, I would say, undemocratic way, perhaps you feel differently about the details of that, but you might say they were unfair to Bernie. But either way, I think that they're going to be a little bit more open to, here's what the people really want, and we're not going to try to use kind of some sort of a trickery or way to manipulate the system to put out the person that we want, because they know that if they screw with us again, yeah, we'll do it. We'll go Trump again. You want to keep this up? Let's do it. We'll do it till the fucking buildings are on fire if you want, you know?
Well, so right. So that's my question. Assume that that's the case, right? Okay. Assume that you have succeeded in making the DNC more open, more fair, however you want to define that. I would add, by the way, we see the problems with having a fully, you know, open and fair and no thumb on the scale. Like, if you don't think the Republicans would have loved to have had a primary system where they could have stopped Donald Trump, then
that,
you know, I
don't
know what
to tell you. That is a very good point.
I do not want my party nominating the Democratic equivalent of Donald Trump. But assume that, hand wave that argument away. Assume you're right.
Wait. What would the Democratic version of Donald Trump be?
We tried to come up with it, but like,
I'm
seriously,
I'm trying to think of
right?
one. Like, it would be that's a funny idea. But anyway, please go ahead.
Bob Torricelli from New Jersey. Like, I mean, I don't know, but like a corrupt narcissist with no history of public involvement. Right. It's hard.
Steve Harvey would be the Democratic version.
Who knows, right? Like, yeah,
that'd be a TV guy or something. Anyway, I'm sorry. Please continue your point.
No, but we need, you know, so ignore that as a problem. Assume you're right that you get reform at the DNC is having President Trump, and what he's actually doing to real people right now, is that worth that price to you? This is an easy question. This should not require you to sigh hard. You should say, no, if 25 million people lose their health care because I wanted to send a message about reforming the DNC, my priorities were out of whack. And I will tell you again, I want to look back to the Howard Dean example. What did we do, Dean supporters, after Howard Dean got a screw job in 2004? We elected him chair of the DNC in 2004. And by the way, I think he's the finest chair that the DNC has had. The Democrats retook the House of Representatives in 2006. I mean, it was he put into place the 50-state strategy, so we won in states like Montana and Idaho. And if Howard Dean were DNC chair now, I would feel much better about a lot of these special elections that are coming up. That's how you reform the system, right? You say, okay, DNC screwed my candidate, gonna vote for the Democratic candidate for president, and then I'm gonna come back, and when we have a Democratic president, I will take it out on the goddamn DNC, right? Like, go after them, make them reform. But like, having President Trump is not a fair, right? Like, that cost is not worth reforming the DNC, in my view, even if I thought that that the goal of having a more open process is is 100% positive.
Let's compare this to some kind of like feudalistic analogy, right? Something to kind of step out of our own personal modern day politics and say, okay, here you've got the kings and he's going to invade your land and he's going to offer you this option if you don't fight back. I feel like you and I could be, you know, standing on a stage right now barking out at people listening, and I say, hey, you know, let's fight this thing tooth and nail. And you're saying, yeah, but if we do, is it really worth all the dead bodies to get this revolution? Is it really worth, like, whenever you compare it to healthcare, for instance, or something like that? I mean, we are talking about real consequences, and I agree with you 100%. And I got to tell you, your arguments are excellent. They are flawless with their logic, but I feel like it's lacking, and I mean no disrespect to you about this at all, but it's the argument itself. It's lacking a little heart. It's lacking a little bit of balls to say, you know what? I am not going to take this. I'm not going to take this kind of unjust manipulation of our electoral process. So would you say the analogy at least fits a little bit?
If what you're saying is that people were angry and wanted to fight, I agree with that. And I certainly, I mean, I don't think that I'm without passion on this issue, as you just heard. I get that. And I guess what I'm trying to promote is the idea of understanding the context for that anger, right? Like, in my view, you know, you and I agree that misplaced anger on the right resulted in President Trump. And you look back, and I talk to some of these people and I say, like, did you really vote for this? Right. Did you vote for Betsy DeVos, dismantling public education? And did you vote for, you know, kicking 25 million people off of health care? And did you vote for, you know, repealing?
Gorsuch.
Yeah, I've done 8 shows on Gorsuch. So, yeah, like that. You want to push my buttons? Go ahead.
No, I've heard them. And,
I know.
I'm with you, man.
Right. So and I say to them and they say, yeah, I was mad and I didn't like Hillary Clinton. And I say, okay, well, maybe we've learned something about, you know, don't vote angry. and that's all I'm trying to do on our side as well, is look back and go, I get it. I get being angry. Maybe I wasn't as angry as you. Look, I was not. I was a Hillary supporter from the beginning for, you know, reasons we could get into if you find that interesting. But I get being angry, and it's why I tried to draw upon, you know, my experience of being angry in 2001, because I was angry, right? And there was a time in which I thought I was not going to vote for John Kerry, right? I get it. And I guess what I'm trying to say is, being angry has consequences too, and sometimes you've got to, you know, swallow the bile in the back of your throat and go, yeah, I'm angry on that, but I'm not that angry, it took a while for me to come around to Hillary Clinton, because I was an Obama supporter in 2008, and obviously Hillary Clinton supporters were in the same position as Bernie Sanders supporters in 2016, right? In 2008, they felt like they didn't like their treatment during the primary. They didn't like the results of the long campaign, and they were angry. And give them credit that 99% of them came around. I faulted Hillary Clinton for some sort of less than, you know, full throated endorsements, and for, you know, bringing up some talking points that wound up, I think, you know, permanently hurting Obama. Right. Like, remember the bitter clinging to their guns thing. That was a Hillary Clinton primary argument against Barack Obama in 2008. So, you know, there was a rift between Obama and Clinton in 2008 that they got behind. And I look at it now, man. And let me tell you why I think this is important. Okay. The Democrats are almost certainly going to take back the House in 2018 if these current trends continue. We're going to have these conditions where it's a primary race in upstate Montana, and there are going to be two candidates, right? And the first candidate is going to be somebody who is a conservative Democrat, cattle rancher, pro-gun, And they're going to run against a genuine progressive liberal candidate. And all of us are going to be like, go Star Moonbeam. And we're going to go out of, and like Star Moonbeam is going to lose to the establishment cattle rancher candidate.
Star Moonbeam.
Yeah, I'm trying to come up with the worst possible nominee.
No, it's perfect. You
know, a vegan, Wiccan, lesbian, yeah. You know, right? And like, it'll be really close. Like Star Moonbeam is going to ride all the anger and she's going to lose 51-49 and there's going to be irregularities. And I need those Democrats in Montana to say, angry, wanted Star Moonbeam. I'm going to go pull the lever for cattle rancher, you know, C. Irwin Harrison IV. And I know he's a corporatist Democrat. I know he's a sellout, but God damn it, we need to retake the Congress. Right.
Right.
And I worry about the Bernie supporters. I worry about people who are still mad, who say things like this was not a democratic process, because that's a high charge. Right. Like that says, I think an election was stolen. And that then to me, that's a tough argument to make. And in any event, you know, you got a narrow tool. And in my view, you know, I want to make sure we get people who agree, who 100% agree right now. Like you and I are like, the priority for 2018 is to stop Donald Trump. And what I am trying to do is make sure that we get to that finish line. So that's why I care about that. That's kind of my
fair
my
enough. Response. Fair enough. And I appreciate, obviously we don't line up perfectly on this, but I do appreciate the marketplace of ideas of bouncing stuff back and forth. And one thing to give credit where it's due, I gotta say your original point that this whole thing has kind of been circling is
your vote
not
is not a
message. Yes, that's powerful, and that's something that I will be thinking about, Andrew. That's a very good point.
I can't ask for more than that. And I want to extend, you know, the same thanks and consideration. You know, we may disagree, but you certainly gave me a more than fair hearing to discuss and offer a counterposition. So, you know, in my view, I mean, this is to me, this is what unites us on the left and as progressives, right, is that we are fundamentally committed to finding out the truth, to calibrating our positions to respond to the evidence and the actual facts on the ground, and at our best we're willing to to listen to each other
Essentially, it's not that we're disagreeing on some very base issues here. We're disagreeing on strategy, on how to get there. We both want to get to the same place. You're just saying right, I'm saying left. Well, I guess right and left are the wrong examples, but you know what I mean. You're saying let's go down this path, and I'm saying let's go this path, but we're both trying to get to the same place. And I think you're right. We damn sure better figure it out and get on the same path, because we're not going to get to our mutual location, our mutual goal, if we don't. So I'll give you that.
I couldn't have said that better myself. So
I feel like we've taken up the whole show with this conversation, but I wouldn't have had it any other way. Before I let you go, here I have an expert on the show, and there's something I had Dan Barker on recently talking about FFRF's suit concerning they didn't abolish the Johnson Amendment, but just how they told the IRS, do not enforce the Johnson Amendment. Can I get your take on this real quick?
Yeah. So my quick take on the Johnson Amendment, you explained on the previous show with Dan Barker what it is. It's the additional aspect of giving an organization 26 USC 501c3 status that requires that they not engage in various kinds of political activities directly, endorsing, supporting candidates, or for or against legislation. The executive order with respect to the Johnson Amendment is five parts nonsense, right? Of just like flowery language that does nothing. But Section 2 of that executive order directs the Department of Justice to not enforce restrictions under the Johnson Amendment that have, quote, traditionally not been enforced against specifically religious institutions. And what that does is it takes advantage of the fact that for a while, the position at the IRS that was responsible for ensuring compliance with the Johnson Amendment was unfilled. It went unfilled for like 18 years. And then even after it was filled, the IRS has internally just had a policy where they are not directing their investigative resources towards churches that engage in political activity. That's a bad thing. We should try and fix that. But having an executive order that then says, no, that's the that is the binding interpretation of the law is, in my view, incredibly dangerous. So I'm really, really glad that the FFRF has brought that lawsuit. I want to say, again, as a lawyer, right, I'm somebody, I have helped charities organize as 501c3s and 501c4s. And if you're not a church and you organize as a 501c3 and you do, I send out a 6-page memo to my clients after I help them organize. And I say, look, like, you cannot so much as hint or wink or make a joke about a political election or, a ballot referendum or, you know, a piece of legislation, because the IRS will see that and they will revoke your tax exempt status. They are aggressive in policing every organization that is not a church. They are deliberately blind when it comes to policing churches and directing them to continue that as an official policy of the government, in my view, is intolerable. So if you'll pardon the joke, like, Dan's doing the Lord's work on that one.
Mm-hmm. Do you think this is going to lead to or increase something that's already happening likely, but lead to dark money going from political activist groups through churches now to support candidates in the future?
Yeah, and look, there's already a ton of that, but here's the distinction, right? I can already do that by establishing a 501c4 organization, right? And that is literally the reason that it has that number is because it's the provision that's under 501c3 in section Title 26 of the U.S. Code. So I can form a 501c4. It is still tax exempt on its income. It can spend money to influence elections and lobby political candidates and lobby on legislative issues. The only distinction is when I give to a 501c4, that donation is not tax deductible by the donee, right? By the donor, right? So, in other words, when you're a 501c3, you get benefits coming and going. Your income is tax exempt, but also when people make charitable gifts to a 501c3, they can deduct that from their taxes.
But
go ahead.
Sorry, but with a 501c4, don't they still have to show where the money came from?
It depends. So, I mean, the answer is it depends in terms of.
Well, the only reason I ask is because a church wouldn't have to, and that's what makes me wonder. Like I'm with you where you say, like, well, that's already in place, and all you have to do is 501c4. But obviously,
but I didn't mean to minimize the damage, right? Literally the effect of this is now for wealthy billionaires, for, you know, your Sheldon Adelson types, we're going to say not only can you continue to pour money in to influence the political system, but we will pay you to do that. Right. By allowing you to deduct it from your taxes. And that is that's an enormous benefit. So that if my kind of lawyer answer made it sound like I'm not scared of this, like, I'm definitely scared.
Right. And well, I kind of feel like that's one thing that for people like myself and probably majority of the listeners that are laymen to this kind of legal mumbo jumbo. And whenever we hear someone, a professional like yourself, speaking about this, it's almost like we kind of get lost in a lot of the dialogue of it and a lot of the vernacular that you're using sometimes. And it's almost as if it's intentional. Would you say that the legal system is constructed in a way and the wording of it is that way by necessity? Or is there a certain intent to confuse the public so that only those that can afford legal representation, perhaps, or only those that are even the the best legal representation, are able to meet their goals and get what their goals are, whereas the rest of us just sit back and say, I kind of feel helpless to this because I don't understand it.
It's a good and serious question, and it's one that I really do worry about. First, I think it's, if I can hijack again, I think that's a pretty good commercial for my show, right? Like, it's part of what I'm trying to do is help people, you know, sort of feel more comfortable in navigating these waters and hearing these, you know, sort of crazy terms. The answer is a mixed bag, right? Like, there are, because our law has developed in lots of different ways, right? So one of the things I talk about is real property law. That is, when you buy a house, or when you have a will, or when you deed a piece of property over to somebody else, right? That stuff is only loosely changed. It is inherited from British common law. And so it's only loosely changed from, like, the law of the Angles and the Saxons in 13th century, you know, Brittany, right? Like, and so there are aspects of it that, like, use specific words and that make no sense and are, you know, 800 years worth of arcane, and I can't defend that, because it's crazy. And so, you know, if you've ever bought a house and, like, have looked at the deed to your house, you're like, I don't understand a damn word of this. And,
yeah, I just signed where they told me to. It's like, yeah. It's like tax law to me.
Yeah. So some of our law is common law. It is inherited. It is confusing because it's 800 years old. Some of our law is, like tax law, deliberately confusing, because, the tax code is, and I realize I'm kind of coming in and this is sort of a, like, point that has been hijacked by, conservatives and libertarians. But the tax code is where, lots of giveaways have been, you know, hidden over the years, in terms of, you know, the senator from Montana manages to get a deduction for cattle ranching into the tax code, right? So, so there are a lot of boondoggles and giveaways, and so it's deliberately confusing because it hides political largesse. What I would say to defend, because again, you know, remember, patriot, American lawyer, love this country. In the beginning of the 20th century, the law underwent kind of a major rewrite, and we abolished something called the forms of action that I refer to on my show from time to time, that were specific pleading requirements that required you to use the right words in the right way. And the federal rules of civil procedure that were drafted at the time and that are in mostly the same form today, say, essentially, you know, you can write a complaint on a napkin in crayon, and the court is required to construe that napkin with, you know, all inferences in favor of the plaintiff, right? In other words, we tried to kind of demystify the law and say, oh, you're not going to, if somebody did something wrong to you, we are not going to create a system that makes it impossible for you to, as a layperson, to write that down. And I think there's some progress with respect to that. I've talked a lot about how, you know, I go into court and opposing lawyers will make fairness arguments, right? They will just say, Judge, you shouldn't do this in this, right? Because it wouldn't be fair, right? I've got a case right now involving a landlord who is trying to enforce an auto renew provision in the lease, in a residential lease against my client, that kicked in and was in the fine print. It was in, like, paragraph 62 of the lease, and he didn't know, and they didn't tell him, and they're like, yeah, but, you know, it says, you know, you had to tell us by day one, and you only told us on day four, so now you owe us, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And a key part, I mean, it's not at the court stage yet, but a key part of the argument, if it ever got there, would be, yeah, this is not, it's not fair on a, you know, somebody's apartment to bury in a provision in paragraph 62 and then, you know, come in here and strictly enforce it against them. And so, you know, so it's a mixed bag. I realize that's an overly lengthy answer, but
no, not at all.
You had a lawyer on the show. You had to know that.
Well, I will say this, much like whenever I listen to your podcast, having you here and having the opportunity to interview you, I've learned a lot and I've been challenged. So I really appreciate that. Those are two things that are valuable to me, and I'm sure they're valuable to the listener. How can people find you, aside from obviously looking at your Opening Arguments podcast? How can people learn more about you?
Follow on Twitter at OpenArgs. The page on Facebook, just search for Opening Arguments podcast, and openargs.com. So those are the easiest ways to get a hold of me. I love interacting with the community, and you know, we're pretty responsive, you know, on the show in terms of talking to listeners. So
and that is where they can send the feel the burn memes to, right?
Yeah, oh yeah, no, bring them on, guys. I'm used to it by now, and I can I wouldn't dish it out if I couldn't take it. So.
Well, thank you so much for your time, sir. It has been educational for me,
Robert. I've really enjoyed being on the show. I thought this was a great exchange. Like I said, I mean, I appreciate the sort of more than full opportunity to be heard, and I am sure your Bernie bro friends are going to be like, "Why did you let it? Well, you didn't. You should have said." And you let me talk and treated my position with respect, and I think that's one of the highest compliments that I can give out. So thanks for having me on. Thanks for treating me well. And let's do this again sometime.
Talking to Andrew Torres was a learning experience for me. I really enjoyed that. And you know what? I learned a few things. He really challenged my views about the election. I'm going to spend some time thinking about that, as I'm sure you will as well. While you're thinking that over, remember that you can find our topic on nuclear war in Krishna on YouTube. If you want to watch it, the topics are always better when presented in video format. Subscribe to that channel. Also, we need your help getting this message out, so share our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at RightToReason1. Rate us on iTunes and Stitcher. You can support us at patreon.com/right and learn more at therighttoreason.com. I'll leave you with this excerpt that was edited out of today's Gigi spot. She's hilarious. So here you go. Hey, I'll talk to you crazy people next week. Thanks for joining me today.
But not only that, but they actually are rated 4 stars on Charity Navigator. So these guys are really amazing program. And please, I mean, not only do they need your donations, but I mean, you can go in and give your time, okay? You can go and volunteer, and this volunteer program, it's so awesome, because not only are you giving your time, you're giving your money, you're helping the kids out, but...
You didn't need to go over this at all, did you?
Yeah, I did.
Why don't you know anything about it?
I don't know.
You just keep repeating yourself. How do you not know? Like, you're going through the page like you don't know where the information is?
I saw it, but I didn't really care. Okay, all right.
I don't know where we left off.